everyone. I'm Brad Rieger, and welcome to the first installment of the Father Jim Basic podcast. And just let me tell you, this is a work in progress, but for now we envision Father Basic's podcast to be a thoughtful dive into topics that Father Basic covers in his lectures, his articles, and books. And as most of listeners know, Father Basic is a world-renowned Catholic theologian, an adjunct professor of theology at Lourdes University, and he recently celebrated 60 years in the priesthood. So welcome, Father Basic, to your own podcast.
Thanks, Brad.
And we envision this to be an ongoing thing, and the thing we're talking about, the lecture we're talking about, occurred last week, and the title was Maintaining Democracy, Current Threats and Responsible Responses. And let me just start off by saying, why did you focus on democracy as one of your lecture topics? And then a follow-up to that would be, how did you prepare for that?
Got it, Brad. In terms of full disclosure, Brad is not only one of the world's great interviewers, but also a friend.
Yes, absolutely.
So it's good to be with you, Brad. I'm recalling what Benjamin Franklin said after the Constitutional Convention. When asked, what did you bring forth? He said, a republic, if you can keep it. If you can keep it. And it's been challenged throughout history. So it's been challenged at the time, obviously, of the Civil War, other times. But I think it's a great challenge today. And therefore, it is an opportune topic. In fact, I think of it not just as one of many possible topics, but the most crucial question that we can address today. And in terms of, let me just expand on that, why it's important. Many commentators say, well, we're at the biggest crisis since the Civil War. You know, Pope Francis said that democracy all over the world is in retreat. She gave a talk in Greece, in Athens, the birthplace of democracy. Democracy all over the world is in retreat. I think there's something around 65% of Americans think that democracy is in crisis today. So it's felt by the population as a whole. Experts see it that way. And it's absolutely vital. I said, I think at one time in a lecture, I say something, this isn't just one more lecture to me. It's of absolutely crucial importance. It's more than one other lecture. The country's at stake. Many things are at stake.
You started your lecture with that Ben Franklin quote. Yeah. I thought it was a great way to frame the messiness and the difficulty of democracy.
Exactly. That's what the Pope said, too, in his comments. He said, authoritarianism is easy. Democracy takes hard work.
For sure.
You've got to continue to work at it. It's messy. It's complex. It requires participation. It requires hard work. And so that's, again, part of why I chose that. Then you asked about preparation. I'd say I had about a month to prepare because I had just given a previous lecture that took up a lot of my time. And so I tried to read everything I could find on it. I tried to pay attention to the news, pay attention to what was going on in our country and in the world. And then what I do is I try to assemble ideas. And I put them forth in background notes that people could get on my website, background notes to the lecture. And a lot of ideas there, a lot of commentaries, a lot of summaries of books or articles. And then what I'm always trying to do is to figure out how you can package that so that it answers people's real needs or concerns. I always say, how do you package it? How do you put it together? And frankly, I didn't find a very good way to do that. I thought of various dialogues and between different factions and so on. So I decided to do it just straightforward, to figure out what are the main threats and how can we respond to them. And I divided those threats into two parts. One I called cultural or spiritual threats, like attacks on truth itself and other strategic or political things like not certifying elections. So I divided the material in that way. Right. And then I just sort of did it straightforward from there.
One other preparation question, and maybe you do this all the time. You looked at various sources of news from news outlets with different points of or vantage points.
I did, yeah.
Is that something that you do even when you're not talking about democracy?
Yes.
Just to see what other various points of view are?
I do, yes. Yes, I do. I listen to Fox News, especially at night. Laura Ingraham is one of my ones that I pay attention to. When Rush Limbaugh was alive, I listened to his program a lot of times when I was driving. I also read the New York Times and listen to CNN and so on. So, yeah, trying to get different perspectives. Now, no one has a objective perspective entirely.
Right.
You know, nobody, you always have a perspective. You got an outlook on something, and that's going to come through. But what I think to be upfront about that is good, and I think that then one can begin to see, well, where is my own bias? Where are my blind spots? What do I fail to see? And so on. But we're not striving for total objectivity.
Right.
We're striving for a straightforward outlook on what my own bias and outlook is and how that filters in with other perceptions.
Right. One of your main themes you talked about, and it was a threat, was the attack on the truth.
Yeah.
And we can't seem to get to a same set of facts.
Yeah.
Or at least close to it.
Yeah.
Well, and it seems that telling the truth was a pretty basic thing until recently. And maybe I'm not seeing that right, but telling the truth isn't a given anymore or even as valued.
Yeah.
And those are blanket statements, but.
Yeah, you're right. I took that as my first point of attack on democracy is disregard for the truth. I remember Washington Post was keeping track of Trump's supposed fabrications, and Kellyanne Conway, one of his advisors, Trump's advisor, says, well, but there's alternate facts. And that very phrase strikes, there's alternate facts. Mm. Truth itself is at stake. Remember Time Magazine ran an article on the post-truth world,
right?
Post-truth era. Many people talk about that. And I like the way you said that people, lying has always been part of the human condition,
sure.
Right?
Yeah.
In any situation, in politics, for sure. But now it seems as though people are not ashamed of lies.
Yeah.
In other words, they don't feel a need. Well, I didn't mean this or that. There's no shame connected with it. And very often in our political world, there's no consequences to it,
right,
to lying. So it creates a new perception, I think, of how we see this working out in the public arena. The whole idea of John Courtney Murray, one of the great Catholic theologians, the greatest Catholic theologian in the history of the United States, wrote a book called We Hold These Truths. Mm-hmm. And Murray said that there's barbarians at the gate. I just realized I'm repeating what I said in the lecture. I shouldn't, there's no sense repeating that stuff. But Murray said we got barbarians, and barbarians are at the gates. And they're the people who prefer demagoguery to dialogue,
right,
who have no regard for the truth. And so what Murray thought was that there were clear sort of philosophical truths that we should hold on to,
right,
okay? He was writing in the 1950s, the Eisenhower era, when things were pretty tranquil by our standards,
right,
today,
right,
and saying that he was worried there's barbarians around. Well, he's proved to be prescient. This is exactly what we've got today. But he said that there is some truths that we can know by reason, that we can argue about. And he put it, and we hold these truths to be self-evident. Oh, our founding doctrine, self-evident, that all men are created equal, endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. So, but then there's another thinker that I think is even more helpful to us today, than, and that's the Jewish philosopher Hannah Arendt. And Hannah Arendt said, look, at, there's all kind of truths. There's scientific truths, and there's other truths, and one of those is factual truth. And that she thought for the democratic process to work, factual truth was what you had to have. People arguing in the Congress, they have different opinions. Fine, you know, no problem. They're going to argue things out, come to policy things, and so on. But unless you have factual truth, you can't have an argument. Mm. So, yeah, truth. You know, anyway.
If you're in a small group setting, it could be a social setting, could be at a lecture, could be in a small group, and you feel that divisiveness, have you had to step in, or have you been able to give how do you handle that when you're in a room and the tension is there? No one's really interested in getting to the facts. It's stating the opinions. How do you handle that?
Not well.
Who does, right?
Yeah, very hard. I mean, we're in an odd situation. You know, I know marriages that have broken up over political matters. Mm. I know gay unions that have broken up. It's just so hard. I think it's possible to feel our way sometimes. So we're dealing with the big lie, right? The big lie that the 2020 election was stolen. Now, if one of my relatives thinks that, sometimes I will say nothing, because it's not going to go anywhere. I'm going to alienate them.
Right.
We'll no longer ever be able to talk, and so on. But now and then there's a person who seems to me to be fairly open, and where you could start to have a dialogue, like, you think the election was stolen. Now what evidence do you have for that? You know.
Pass the gravy.
Yeah, right. You know, what evidence do you have? So. Right. It was like Billy Graham's son said that Trump has been right about so many things that I presume he's right about the election being stolen. That's one line of argument. Well, you had the other line of argument, Sidney Powell, lawyer, that the voting machines were all rigged. So, in other words, it's possible, it seems to me, to begin to enter into some sort of questioning thing, like, well, how did you turn around 80,000 votes in Pennsylvania? You know, I find it very difficult. I would say it's very seldom that I've been successful in any kind of opening up of dialogue. I have seen it happen,
yeah.
But it's prudence, and everyone's going to be different, right, yeah. Bragg?
Yeah.
You're going to say it one way, mm-hmm. and maybe you're quiet with certain people, and others you might talk. But are you going to ask me about Václav Mali?
We can. Go to town, yes.
I mean, to me, yeah, I'd like to say more about him.
It's your podcast. I think you can. You have the latitude to go.
Yeah, thanks. As I said, you're a friend.
Yes, absolutely.
Mali was ordained in 1976 as a priest of the Prague Diocese, Czechoslovakian. And the next year, he signed the 77 Charter, calling for the communist regime to resign. Okay? Mm-hmm. And it became a movement. Václav Havel, the playwright, became the president, was leading that. I remember seeing on our television, we had documentaries showing 500,000 people in Wenceslas Square, you know, yelling for the communist regime to resign, essentially.
Right.
And I remember a great chant going up, Mali, Mali, Mali. That's M-A-L-Y, by the way, Mali, Mali, Mali. So he was a great favorite of that. And because he showed opposition, he was arrested 250 different times.
Mm.
He spent 9 months in jail. He wasn't allowed to function as a priest, though he did so quietly. And he was, on one occasion, tortured badly.
Yeah.
And he said at that time he saw that only Christ was with him. He was isolated with brutal tortures. Only Christ could be with him. So he was a powerful man, a great individual. And I got the opportunity to talk with him in Prague, in his apartment. And I'm going to say it was about 1992, after the Velvet Revolution succeeded, and the communist regime was overturned, and Havel was elected president, and Mali said, I'm not going to be part of the government. They wanted him to be part of the government. And he wanted to remain part of the spiritual world, the church world, so he could speak truth to power, truth to power. And then in this interview, it was just so touching. It was in a small, tiny apartment. The surveillance camera was still outside his apartment, so anybody who went in would be seen. And he was gracious with his time. And the main point, and I think I did make this point in the lecture, that he said, you have to stand up for truth. I found out in my own life that I couldn't give in one inch. They weren't asking me to renounce the faith or anything.
Right.
They just said, just mute the criticism of the government a little bit. And he wouldn't give in to that.
He wouldn't do that.
You know, and then he told me what's echoing in my own mind and heart as I gave that lecture. And in your own situation, United States, you must stand up for the truth. Stand up for the truth and don't give an inch. And that's what was in my own head as I gave that lecture. This great, courageous man who's still alive now. He's an auxiliary bishop of Prague and still fighting for the faith and for the truth and was ready to criticize the new government as well as the old one. So that was in my mind and heart as I give the lecture.
So Mali was a great motivator, inspiration to do this.
Yeah,
yes.
And especially on this idea of truth.
Yeah.
You know?
Another threat that you discussed was the voter apathy.
Yeah.
Because obviously democracy needs informed and participatory citizens for it to work, right? The voting rates are pretty abysmal. So how do we re-engage people, especially our young people?
Yeah. Boy, you're all over that. The young, so important. You know that in this last election in 2020, was the first time over half of the young people, 18 to 29, voted. Up till then, less than half voted every year.
Right.
We finally got up to 53% of young people voted in 2020, which is amazing given the COVID thing and everything.
Right.
So it was an 8% increase over 2016. So, yeah, I mean, it's like the Pope said, it takes hard work. You got to participate. You got to be part of it. But we've got ourselves a great problem. And, you know, one of the ideas that I got from somebody else, as I always said, if I have an original idea, I'll let you know. It's all borrowed from somebody.
Right.
But, you know, somebody said, how about if you'd make a pact? Say you have an 18-year-old nephew, and he's not into voting or whatever, and so you make an agreement with the 18-year-old, we're both going to vote, we're going to hold each other, and you know we'll go together and whatever, and make an agreement that we will both vote. That's a way of bringing the young person along. A lot of other things we find out is that young people who are involved in other activities, who write their congressperson or who go to rallies for whatever cause are more likely to vote.
Right.
So we have to, a lot of people are saying, well, we need more civics classes in high school. What do you think of that idea as an educator?
Yeah. I mean, I think to talk about history in real terms and that, if we want to continue on with the freedoms that we have, I think the real issue is we just take it for granted that it kind of naturally happens and that democracy really involves the hard work and participation. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a big piece, is that if we want to continue to have the lifestyle that we have in this country, it's going to take an additional, a lot
more. Are those civics courses taught in high schools?
There are, yes, yes.
So it does happen.
It does happen, and the importance of, there's always a government class that usually typically takes place in the senior year of students. And
is that right?
A lot of great conversations about the practicalities of what it means to be an American and what the branches of government actually really mean and how they work.
Yeah.
I think that's, but it also starts at home too, right? So let me ask you this, how were you introduced to the importance of voting?
Yeah.
For yourself.
Well, it's sort of idiosyncratic because my parents always voted, but they never told each other or me, any of the children, they never told any of us how they voted. And so we never shared that, but they voted and encouraged us to vote, of course. So there's always been a secrecy connected with
it. It's
that.
Important, but secret.
Yeah. In my family, as I say, it's idiosyncratic. I'm not sure how many families would be that strictly secretive about their vote.
Right.
But I did get the impression from them that it was an important thing to do, and that my sisters voted and so on, yeah.
Right. Any great... I was also struck in your talk when you talked... when you framed it that when problems are increasing or are deemed or perceived to be unsolvable, that's where the gravitation toward authoritarian leaders takes place. That was a really...
Yeah.
And you had some really good examples. What will it take from our elected officials, our corporate leaders, our educational leaders, nonprofit? What type of behaviors do you think need to occur to kind of reestablish or deal with some of these threats?
Yeah. You know, John Courtney Murray said that, interesting to me, that there would only be a few people who would be able to turn things around, who could fight the barbarians. He didn't think that you could get a mass movement. He didn't think you'd get, you know, vast majority of politicians to fight the barbarians. You would have to have a few. And if we had a few people, well, let's be straightforward about it. If we had Republican leaders who would say the election was not stolen, you know, and would be able to speak up and follow through on that and gain adherence of others, that would be a way forward. In other words, we have to fight the big lie. I mean, it's there. Look in our own state, right? You got running for Senate, J.D. Vance, author of the Hillbilly Elegy, is, you know, the election was stolen, clearly. You know, and we've had that. Maybe we could build on it because... we had the Attorney General say that it was not stolen. We had Mitch McConnell say that, Senate Minority Leader. But so I find that interesting that Murray thought it would only be a few who could do that, who would have enough principle, enough courage, enough understanding to be able to speak up. And I think... you know, some people have spoken up, but I don't think it's really hit us. It doesn't seem as though it's broken through. It could be that we got a hard core of 30% of the public who thinks the election was stolen and it's never going to change. I mean, I don't know that. I don't want to be pessimistic about it. Whenever we talk about these things, I think it's important to distinguish optimism from Christian hope.
Sure.
Christian hope is optimism is based on a factual thing. And you look at our situation, polarized political situation, it would be hard to have great optimism, wouldn't it? I mean, who's got great optimism about Congress coming together and coming up with solutions? Right. You know, but Christian hope says that God is on our side in the struggle against evil, that God wants good to win out. You know, that the Christian idea is that eventually the good will win over the evil. That Martin Luther King liked to use that line, the moral law of the universe is law, but it bends towards justice. That's more of a statement, not of optimism, in my mind,
right,
as enigmatic as it is. It's a statement of Christian faith, Christian hope, that, of course, generated King's whole outlook on life. And so I like to, in the midst of all the pessimism you can talk about and the threats to democracy, I'd like to think about that eventually the dark forces can't defeat God's love. Demonic force is always with us, always will be. But in the end, final word is yes to goodness and no to demonic forces. So I try to, I mean, in terms of my own effort to keep my hopes up and keep in the fight, one of the things that's helpful with that is then you don't get cynical. So one of the reasons you said about voting, one reason people don't vote is because of cynicism.
And doesn't matter what I...
And no one cares, and therefore I'm not going to vote. And what Christian hope does, and you could do the same thing with Judaism or Islam, but from the Christian perspective, if we know that God is going to triumph over all the evil, then it makes sense to put our own effort into achieving that. So in Christian terms, we say Christ called us to spread the kingdom of justice and peace and love. Christ called love of neighbor, spread the kingdom of God in the world. That's our calling as Christians. In fact, we should be more concerned about it than other people because of our faith, and that then can motivate us to do our little bit, like trying to talk your nephew into voting with you, or talking, find one person in your life that would be open to saying that the big lie is not right.
Yeah. Well, I think you just summed up the Christian hopefulness and optimism. I think that's a good way to end our first conversation. And just thank you for having the courage to bring it forward, this idea of the threats and some of our responsibilities to maintain democracy. And it's been a pleasure, as always.
Thanks, Brad.